Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And some big economic news today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average passed the 18,000 mark. That's a first. And the U.S. economy grew 5% between July and September. Jeremy, that's the strongest growth in the third quarter in more than a decade. I've done my part because it's in large part due to consumer spending.
Well, and if other listeners have been doing some spending, they may have noticed a lot of things that you've noticed, that things are sold out already, many items. And for more on that, let's bring in Sucharita. Sucharita Mulpuru. She is a retail analyst with Forrester Research. She's with us from Philadelphia. Sucharita, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Well, how would you rate this holiday season so far for retailers?
Well, I think that it had a little bit of a questionable start. There were a lot of reports that the Black Friday and Thanksgiving weekend were a little lackluster. But I think that there has definitely been a lot of steam that the industry has picked up in the month of December. A lot of reports that stores are doing very well, and not just online stores, but it's also the bricks and mortar stores. And I think it's everything from customer confidence to these great gas prices we have now.
You think the gas prices are making that big of a difference in the holiday sales?
Well, potentially. I mean, it does put a few more discretionary dollars into the pockets of consumers. And what that means is that you may have an additional $20 or $50 or $60 a week that you can then use to buy gifts.
Now, we know to expect the big sales during Black Friday, and they certainly were there. And as you said, it wasn't such a great Black Friday. But I was out at the stores over the weekend, and I still saw 40% off, 50% off. Is this just deep discounting? Are these stores making any money on this?
Well, I think that this is the typical cadence of retail these days, where the expectation is that consumers often choose not to purchase at full retail anyway. And there's a psychological perception that if you're paying full retail, you're paying too much. Hmm. Consumers just like to psychologically have some percent off.
Even if it's not really a discount. We like to
exactly,
think we're getting
that Exactly.
Okay, now here's the really weird part that we're trying to figure out, and that is that things are sold out all over the place. Robin has been trying to get all kinds of gifts that she can't find anywhere. They're sold out, everything from toys to electronic devices to, I think, a Harry and David gift basket. What's going on there? Why are things sold out all over the place?
Well, you know, and I don't know the specific items that you guys are looking for, but my hunch is, and this is actually a trend that we see every year, which is that there are always certain bestsellers that typically do sell out. That's almost always the case. I mean, the toy industry certainly is that's the case, because there are always a handful of bestsellers that will often make their way into the Black Friday doorbuster sales, and then they're sold out by the first week or two of December. And as you mentioned, you know, kind of your best sellers are often sold out, and everything else often gets marked down to 40 or 50% off to try to move through that inventory so you're not stuck with a glut after Christmas.
But I wondered, and I just saw over the weekend, this is many months after the new iPhone came out, they had just gotten to the point at the local Apple store where you could walk in and get one without having to wait days and days for it. But I wondered if these retailers are starting to do things the way that airlines have done them, in that they don't want to have extra inventory. They'd rather sell out.
Yeah, I think that definitely after the last recession, we've started to see more prudence with respect to inventory levels. And what that means is, let's not order crazy amounts that we then have to mark down. Let's just try to have what we know will sell through, and try, especially for our best-selling items, to make sure that we can try to sell it at full price. And I think that, you know, that's another phenomenon that we're seeing in retail that we'll continue to see over the next, I think, few years. Is this idea of not just to price an item according to some, you know, arbitrary margin level, but a little bit more of charging people what we think they would be willing to pay for the item. Hmm. So for those bestsellers that we know sell out quickly, there may be room to raise the price a little bit on a few of those items. I think that certainly Apple and its devices are a great example of that, that they're certainly not inexpensive. And I think that they've done a lot of pricing analysis and a lot of, you know, kind of a number of pricing studies to make sure that they're pricing the item right without leaving money on the table.
You focus specifically on online retail. How is that doing this year compared to years past and compared to the brick and mortar stores?
Well, online retail has been doing very, very well pretty much since its inception, and there is no sign that it is slowing down. So all of these stories of Black Friday, you know, and Thanksgiving weekend doing not so well for the physical retail store, the story was absolutely the opposite in the online world. Those key dates, Thanksgiving weekend, continue to drive double-digit year-over-year sales for most online retailers. Cyber Monday, which is the Monday after Thanksgiving, right, is the biggest shopping day of the year. It's been the biggest shopping day of the year for the vast majority of online retailers for the last few years, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger. So there is no question that online retail is doing just fine. And it is typically the Christmas season and Q4 represent a time where there are a lot of new shoppers. People spend more money online than they do any other time of the year because they often don't want to fight with crowds and look for parking.
On the other hand, I'm worried at this point about buying anything online because I'm not sure that that it's going to get to me or get to the recipient in time.
Yeah, well, this is the Tuesday before Christmas. I would probably urge you to go to the store. So, yeah, if you didn't get it already, it may be too late, in which case you probably do want to hit your local Macy's. But the carriers are getting better and better about meeting the shipping deadlines. But we hit a phenomenon last year, which is that the carriers hit capacity. We'd never had that happen before, where e-commerce essentially flexed the maximum capacity, shipping capacity of the major carriers, especially for express shipments. And then last year, we also had some particularly adverse weather conditions that made situations even worse. But every year, we're going to continue to experience this. And until the carriers start investing in greater capacity, your sweet spot to order will probably be the first couple of weeks in December. The longer you wait, the more likely it is that you may not get your package on time.
Sucharita Mulparu, a retail analyst with Forrester Research. Thanks so much, Sucharita, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you too, Jeremy.
And Jeremy, I want to add one more thing. The NFL ugly Christmas sweaters,
yeah,
almost completely sold out.
There you go.
All right, let's go to Qatar now, where problems continue to plague the country's plans for the 2022 Soccer World Cup. FIFA, the world governing body for soccer, says it will not change the site despite bribery and corruption charges connected to the country's winning bid. As we've reported, it's estimated more than 1,000 migrant workers have died on World Cup-related construction projects. And groups such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch say nothing is being done to fix the problems for the remaining workers. The BBC's Sue Lloyd-Roberts reports.
An hour before dawn in Doha, the night shift pack up as the day shift arrives on what is said to be the biggest construction site in the world. Hundreds of foreign companies are involved in a £200 billion building bonanza to include World Cup stadiums and urban development, employing 1.5 million migrant workers.
I have to support my parents, my wife and a child. It's not enough. I deeply regret ever coming here, but I can't leave.
The company
have my passport.
Company ka passport.
Imran is from Bangladesh and employed by a subcontractor company doing work for the British construction company Carillion. He says he gets barely a quarter the amount promised by the recruitment agency back home. When we told Carillion about Imran, they told us the company employing him provides labour to one of its subcontractors and that they would investigate our findings. When the day's shift ends at 5, we follow a bus taking workers to a camp used by another subcontractor working for Carillion. People have been arrested for talking to migrant workers in Qatar. We had to be quick.
I'm telling you, salaries don't get paid on time. The agency would tell us that the company hasn't got the money, and so our salaries would be delayed.
I ask another man if they have their passports.
None of us gets to keep our passports. I don't know why.
The men here say they get £150 a month and £40 extra for food.
What can a poor man do? I need to earn money.
Although hired by subcontractor companies, this third man tells me they have no doubt who they ultimately work for.
I am working for Carillion. When I'm on the construction site, I don't get safety glasses or gloves. My finger was nearly chopped off while working. I never got compensation. and I had to pay for treatment.
I want to ask another man why he has his leg in plaster when two men burst into the room.
Any permission you have, please?
Sorry.
Any permission you have inside the KMTN?
They threatened to take the camera and were thrown out. Carillion say that health and safety is at the very heart of our business, and practice on site follows standards that we apply in the UK. Our subcontractors must abide by Qatari labour law in respect of wages, living conditions and employment rights, and should comply with that law which prevents employers withholding workers' passports. At the luxurious offices of Qatar 2022, I meet the head of workers' welfare, Farah Al-Mufta.
There are people that might say, because of human rights abuses, you should take the World Cup away. But if the whole aim is to actually improve conditions, then why would you take such a catalyst for change away from the country? Because that will actually hamper the progress that's being made.
She shows me new regulations designed to improve conditions for 1,500 workers employed directly on the stadiums. But what about the rest of the building program, employing 1.5 million?
I can't speak to that project because it's not under our direct oversight, but they, at a minimum, do fall under the labor law, and that is what should be implemented and enforced.
But under that law, workers can't leave Qatar without their employer's consent. A game of football, not in one of the futuristic stadiums, but migrant workers playing on scrub ground on their day off. I meet Mahendra, a Nepali working for a Qatari company.
A lot of workers die because here in Qatar, we are working on tall, tall buildings. And so the workers fall off and die. 14 or 15 people have died where I work.
More than 1,000 migrant workers have died in Qatar since the country was awarded the World Cup. Critics estimate that at that rate, the total could reach 4,000 by the time the tournament kicks off in 2022.
And that report from the BBC's Sue Lloyd-Roberts. We've been looking back at 2014, and today, notable moments that made for great water cooler talk and, in many cases, started a national dialogue. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has his picks. And, Eric, give us an idea. We're talking about those big TV or viral moments that just grabbed us.
Sure. It's become sort of a tradition for critics to pick their best TV shows of the year. But I think it's more important to take a look at those video moments that showed us something unique or changed us as a culture. And several of those things happened this year.
Let's take a look. In the beginning of the year, it was the first season of HBO's True Detective, critically acclaimed, did very well, short season, 8 episodes, starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, 2 detectives in Louisiana working on one case. Let's just play one of these memorable moments you're talking about.
Someone once told me time is a flat circle. Everything we've ever done or will do, we're going to do over and over and over again.
Why'd you pick that, Eric?
True Detective was a film that was stretched across several episodes. And we've seen shows kind of like this in the past, but True Detective took it to a new level. And then we saw it happen to an even greater level when FX reinvented Fargo. So this is a style of television that had a great impact and that we're going to see more of in the future. And this is a singular signature moment.
Okay. This was also a year of a shakeup in late-night television. David Letterman, of course, announcing his retirement in April from The Late Show. But it was a real surprise. He started off by talking about how he had a conversation with his boss, Leslie Moonves.
And I phoned him just before the program, and I said, Leslie, it's been great. You've been great. The network has been great, but I'm retiring.
This is really?
Yep.
This is true. This is, you actually did this?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
Yeah, wow, indeed. This announcement reshuffled the deck in late-night television. Because Letterman was leaving his show, CBS hired Stephen Colbert to come over from Comedy Central. Because he's leaving Comedy Central hired Larry Wilmore to take over that job. And because Stephen Colbert was bringing a new show, CBS and Craig Ferguson decided to leave that show. And now there's going to be a new host on the show that comes after where David Letterman was later in the year in March. So literally a third of late night television kind of reshuffled. New people got new jobs and other people left as a result of this one moment.
Quite a moment. Okay, another one. Earlier this year at the Academy Awards, Lupita Nyong'o won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for her role in 12 Years a Slave. Memorable speech there. But you want to listen to a moment from her speech at the Essence Awards for Black women in Hollywood who really made an impact. Let's listen.
I received a letter from a girl, and I'd like to share just a small part of it with you. Dear Lupita, it reads, I think you're really lucky to be this black, but yet this successful in Hollywood overnight. I was just about to buy Densha's whitenish's cream to lighten my skin when you appeared on the world map and saved me.
She goes on to describe how when she was a child, she actually wished that she would wake up white. And what this is about is how Hollywood and show business have often defined attractiveness as qualities that are natural for white people. And even a woman as beautiful as Lupita Nyong'o was affected by that as a child. And her being able to admit that and say, now I have this career where I'm putting the lie to all of that. That's a singular moment, and it ties into another moment that we're going to talk about in just a second.
Well, I was going to say that race was at the heart of a lot of the moments that really stay with us from the past year. This summer, the protests in Ferguson after 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed by Darren Wilson, the white police officer. So much coverage, but you are sort of picking the overall protest coverage as one of the most memorable moments in 2014?
Yes, this incident and the reaction to Ferguson produced protests across the country and worldwide, and made us all talk about race, talk about policing, talk about white privilege in a way that we really have not talked about these subjects for many years.
Yeah.
It's put these subjects on the table in a way that everyone has to grapple with them, not just people of color. And this media coverage was inherent in making us consider these questions day after day.
Well, then there's another one ongoing. In late October, comedian Hannibal Buress was on tour, and he made a few jokes about Bill Cosby. Now, this is something that had been, you know, percolating in the African-American community, but this is when it started to bubble up. Let's listen.
Skits on TV. Pull your pants up, black people. I was on TV in the 80s. I can talk down to you because I had a successful sitcom. Yeah, it was rape women, Bill Cosby, so kind of brings it down a couple notches. I don't curse on stage. Well, yeah, you're a rapist, so...
This was pretty shocking to people who had not been aware of some of the accusations against Bill Cosby.
Well, you know, I know these allegations were covered extensively in 2004 and 2005 when a woman filed a lawsuit against Bill Cosby and found 13 women who had similar stories who were willing to say that they had been drugged and sexually assaulted by this very famous comedian. But for whatever reason, we had cultural amnesia about that until Hannibal Buress articulated something that I think is the point of view of the younger generation. They didn't grow up with all this landmark work that he did in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s. The Cosby they know is the Cosby who is the scold, the one who comes to them and tells them that their youth culture is damaging and dangerous and regressive. And this was a reaction to that. And that put the conversation on the table in a way. One of the women who accused Bill Cosby years ago wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post, and then the story kind of exploded.
And, of course, Bill Cosby has never been criminally charged with anything, and he denies the accusations, but a national conversation nonetheless. A couple more moments you want to note. The new show that made a big splash was Last Week Tonight with comedian John Oliver. That's on HBO. Here's a memorable moment when Oliver and his team investigate a claim that the Miss America pageant is the world's largest provider of scholarships to women.
Miss Alabama, in its 2012 filing, said it provided nearly $2.6 million in scholarships to just one school, Troy University, which blew my mind. Because if that's true, that must be the single prettiest school anywhere in America.
And then there's the internet video of the young woman in jeans and a t-shirt walking through the streets of New York. We know about this. It went viral. The video showed her being constantly harassed as she walked for 10 hours. Those two, very different. Why'd you choose them?
Okay, so with John Oliver, we're used to TV shows satirizing the news. But what John Oliver did was he reported and then satirized the results of his reporting. So they did investigation, looked into this claim, found out that it was questionable, and then also made fun of it. And so that's a new frontier, and it also gave him a new voice as a late-night news satirist that no one else was really doing. In terms of the internet video, what we saw here was in the same way that the Ferguson coverage put policing as part of the national conversation, this video made street harassment and sexual harassment on the table, got people talking about it. And then the group that made the video had to apologize because most of the people featured were men of color. And they didn't include white men, even though they had some footage of white men doing the same thing. So it put race on the table in a way that they didn't intend.
Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The people have spoken. Freedom has prevailed. That's a tweet from actor Seth Rogen, a star in the controversial film The Interview, after the news today that the movie will be released on a limited basis on Christmas Day. That reversal from Sony comes after the company had pulled the film following a hacking attack and terrorist threats on theaters that were going to run the film. And that decision led to widespread criticism, including from President Obama, who said he disagreed with the action. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal is with us now from New York with the latest on this. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And as we know, and in case I have to remind anybody who's been living under a rock, this is a fictional comedy film about an assassination plot against North Korea's Kim Jong-un, and that's what had made the North Koreans or the hackers so upset about this. What's Sony saying about why they've now decided to release it?
That's right. And a raunchy comedy at that, from what we understand, from not having seen this film, of course. So Sony's president put out a statement just a few hours ago, and it said that we are proud to make it available to the public and to have stood up to those who attempted to suppress free speech. But here's the critics are saying that it looks like Sony really caved, because what happened last week was on Tuesday, Sony made the announcement that they were not going to be showing this film. And people familiar with the company's thinking said that they told the theaters, you know, we're not going to do a limited release. Last week they said, we're not going to do a limited release only, you know, and we will maybe do video on demand, but we're not going to do a limited release. But now, you know, the nation's biggest theater chains are still unlikely to play this film. And it's going to just open in like a fraction of the screens that it was supposed to play on. But on the 25th, it will be seen on some screens.
Yeah, well, as you say, the nation's biggest change, it does not look likely that this is going to be at Regal theaters or AMC theaters. But who is going to show it now?
You know, Sony hasn't said specifically which change, but there were a number of independent theaters that had said earlier on that they wanted to be able to show this film, but were told by Sony, no, you can't. Nobody's getting this film.
What about an on-demand release? We know that had been talked about. Is that in the cards now?
Yes. As part of this announcement, there will be an on-demand release, but they were waiting for details as well. You know, my colleague Eric Schwartzel reported last week that the largest cable companies had said, no, we are not going to show this. But, you know, as you said, there's been a major backlash, you know, not just from from the viewing public, but the number of artists. You had President Obama criticizing last week Sony's call to pull this film, you know, actors, directors, screenwriters. So now the pressure is really on both the theater owners and also on Sony itself.
Well, and there had also been, on the other side, some concern among theater owners, and this is one of the reasons they decided that they didn't want to show this film, that if they were to show that film, that people would be scared away from going to see other movies because they were worried about this terrorist threat that was put out against theaters that were going to play the film. Are the theaters that are going to show this movie now going to have extra security, or are we just going right ahead and saying, no, nobody's scared, let's just do this?
I mean, presumably there may be more security, but we don't have reporting on that yet. I mean, what we do know is that the people who sent out this threat, they basically said they were invoking September 11th. But you've had U.S. officials say, you know what, there's not real credence that they could find to this being a credible threat. Although it can be argued that they made good on their on their threat. They were able to hack into Sony successfully. So maybe they're more powerful than you think. But we don't know yet what the parameters will be for how these theaters are going to show the film.
Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal on the news today. today that Sony is going to allow a limited theatrical release of the movie The Interview on Christmas Day. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you.
New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton reignited a debate yesterday on the Today Show when he directly linked the recent nationwide protests about police use of force in the deaths of Eric Garner in New York and Michael Brown in Ferguson to Ishmael Brinsley, the man whose mother said had undiagnosed mental illness, who shot and killed two New York City police officers on Saturday. Here's what Bratton said.
It's quite apparent, quite obvious that the targeting of these two police officers was a direct spinoff of this issue of these demonstrations.
This is a difficult time
so
in this city.
So can protests cause police killings, or do people with mental health issues perhaps gravitate toward protests, maybe even to mask their symptoms? Jonathan Metzl is director of the Center for Medicine, Health and Society and professor of psychiatry at Vanderbilt University. He studied a possible nexus of mental illness and social protest movements. He joins us by Skype. And Dr. Metzl, your opinion. Can protests cause people who are unbalanced to, you know, go off, or is it the other way around, that maybe they're attracted to protest and social movements, maybe to try to blend in? What's your sense?
I think it's actually somewhat unfortunate that we're having this conversation about this particular case. I thought that Police Commissioner Bratton's assumption that the violent actions of a perpetrator were a spinoff of the demonstrations really was unfortunate for a couple of reasons. And one is that the demonstrations were actually advocating, for the most part, the opposite of what the actions of the gunman turned out to be, and that they were advocating nonviolence, hands up, don't shoot. And the second is that there's a lot of assumption in the media right now about Mr. Brinsley and his psychiatric history, and a lot of it is unknown at this point. It's to be determined.
But there's a, you know, there is a broader question about what is cause and effect here. And while we're putting caveats, and we should add that the majority of people who have mental illness do not commit violence, and the majority of people who protest, whether they're Tea Partiers or the people we're seeing in Ferguson and New York, the majority of them don't commit violence. But as a psychiatrist, as you watch this, what is the nexus between mental health and social protest?
Sure. Certainly, people who are at risk for committing certain kinds of violent acts don't live in a vacuum. And we've seen time and again throughout history that people who commit senseless gun violence do respond to a host of external stimuli. And so we've got examples, everything from Tucson to Aurora, Columbine, and again, I think in this case, where people who are at risk and might be a bit mentally unstable pick up on political or social stimuli and use those as somehow causes for committing certain kind of crimes. Yeah. Again, I think where we get into trouble is saying that the content of that political protest caused the violent act, when I don't think we have the evidence to support that.
Yeah. Well, what about, I'm sure there are people who have the same anecdote I've shared on this program before about watching, you know, someone you care about become part of a protest movement. In my case, it was 20 years ago, and it was someone who started working in a neighborhood that was having problems with the police, and he also started protesting the police. He then began to disintegrate, and it was obvious he was having mental health issues. And we were told at the time he was almost masking those issues because they weren't as obvious. Issues like paranoia aren't as obvious if you're mixed in with a crowd of people that is protesting somebody that you feel paranoid about.
Sure. I mean, the classic definition of paranoia is that you overinflate or overgeneralize an external threat. You internalize that and then project it back out into the world. And certainly people with a propensity toward paranoia do, again, pick up and, as we see in this case, distort the messages of political movements as a means of justifying often illogical or dangerous conclusions. But again, I'd say that there certainly are very painful individual instances of those, and I think that they result in tragedies in many ways. But I think that the larger point, again, is that there is no causal connection between the content of politics and mental illness. And I guess the other point I would want to make about that is that as an aggregate group, there are far more instances of people with mental illness being the victims of violence rather than the perpetrators of violence.
Yeah. And I'm sure there are those who would also add, just because you are protesting doesn't mean you're paranoid or crazy, to paraphrase that comment. Well, while we have you, I just wonder your thoughts as well. We've spoken of the protesters, of the individual in this case who took the lives of two police officers. What would you want to say about police officers right now as far as where their minds might be? Their job is to serve and protect, and yet they are under attack.
Sure. I mean, I can certainly understand the emotions that are coming out on the part of the police commissioner and the police union. You know, I think right now there is a point of commonality that hopefully reasonable minds on all sides of this will get to, which is that if you look just at the Twitter hashtags, Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter, I think there's a common assumption that lives matter in this case. And so I think that hopefully we can build some consensus that doesn't resort to stereotypes or simple blaming like has happened.
I just did a little bit look at the history. You've written about how schizophrenia became a black male diagnosis after the 1960s social protest movement. Put that in context.
Sure. The book I wrote was called The Protest Psychosis, How Schizophrenia Became a Black Disease. And it looked at a cultural moment in 1968, very similar to the one that we're looking at today, in which there were political protests in the air. And the rhetoric of does political protest cause violent symptoms in black men was one that many people thought about, cared about, and debated. Ultimately, what I show was that the ascription of schizophrenia to angry black men was done in many ways incorrectly or unjustly because the rhetoric of schizophrenia was being used not so much to empathize or help support mental symptoms, but instead was being done to pathologize the politics that those men were advocating. So again, I get nervous again when I hear quotes like the protests are causing mental illness because it seems like we're just reliving that moment again.
In other words, you're saying, again, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you're crazy in this point. The angry black men at that time in history had reason to be angry.
And also that calling a social movement paranoid or schizophrenic is a way of not taking seriously the content of the protest. And so it's a way of calling a whole organization or a whole movement mentally ill as a way of not addressing what it turned out in retrospect to be valid concerns about justice and injustice.
Jonathan Metzl, director of the Center for Medicine, Health and Society and professor of psychiatry at Vanderbilt University. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much. It's been my honor.
An exasperated mom calls her son home for the night, but he's seen something miraculous, a star with a tail. And then the next day there's a knock on their humble door. Is it possible, following that star, three kings?
Mother, 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 come with me.
Amal and the Night Visitors is the story of the impoverished widow and her son who hobbles on a crutch and hosts royalty for a night. It was written by Giancarlo Minotti, who was born in Italy but attended Philadelphia's Curtis Institute of Music with Leonard Bernstein and Samuel Barber, who became Minotti's longtime partner. Amal premiered on NBC TV Christmas Eve 1951 and became an instant tradition, as highly anticipated as Santa Claus or Ron Cohen, my former high school choir director who visits us every year at this time, and this year brings an impassioned plea regarding Amal. Mr. Cohen, welcome back.
It is great to be here, Robin, as always.
Yeah. You tell us Minotti may have been inspired by his childhood in Italy.
There is no such thing as Santa Claus, Robin, in Italy. In Italy, it was the three kings that were the big deal, bringing all the gifts. And he had a brother who was completely infatuated with Casper, who he was convinced was quite deaf and a bit zany. And later on, we're going to see that this comes into play with Casper
right, when
he wrote Amal.
Yet he didn't remember this. When he was commissioned by NBC, he didn't remember immediately the three
kings. Not only did he not remember, Robin, but he didn't know what to do. He didn't know what the plot would be. And it's just sheer, shall we say, serendipity. He goes to the Metropolitan Museum, and he ends up seeing the Adoration of the Kings by Bosch. He looks at that, and suddenly just floods into his mind, oh, my Lord, all his lovely childhood memories come to him, and he says, I've got it.
In the TV special, Chet Allen plays Amal. His mother is played by Rosemary Coleman. The three kings, Balthazar, Leon Lischner, Melchior, David Aiken, Casper, Andrew McKinley. And to your point that Minotti kind of fashioned him after his brother's sense of who Casper was, Here Casper is showing Amal his treasured possession.
This is my box, this is my box. I never travel without my box. In the second drawer I keep all my beads. Oh, how I love to play with beads. All kinds of beads. This is my
The last part, the music changes and it sounds like you're going to hear something so mystical and beautiful. And what does Casper say is there?
In the third drawer. Oh, little boy, oh, little boy, in the third drawer I keep licorice, licorice, black sweet licorice, black sweet licorice. Have some.
So a wonderful moment there, which is why children loved this show so much. But soon after, one of the most powerful moments, when the kings tell this impoverished widow, the mother, Enamal, that they're looking for the Christ child. Let's listen to a little of Have You Seen a Child?
Have you seen a child, the color of wheat, the color of dawn? His eyes are mild, his hands are those of a king, as king he was born.
This sort of symbolizes all mothers and children. Has she seen a child? And they're referring to the Christ child. And she's answering, yes, I saw the child. And it's Amal. There's the divine in all of us, especially little children.
Yes, I know a child, the color of wheat, the color of dawn. His eyes are mild, his hands are those of a king. And pouring hungry and cold is my child, my son, my darling, my own.
Well, Ron Cohen, just as we're pulverized by that scene, we move on to the next. The local shepherds come. Word has spread about the kings, and they bring gifts.
This is all the shepherds have.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you kindly, thank you, thank you, thank you kindly.
Citrons and lemons, musk and pomegranates, goat cheese and walnuts, figs and cucumbers.
It's been well over 50 years, and all I can remember, I never forget, thank you, thank you, thank you kind, never forget it. The use of the words are very important. Citrons and lemons, musk and pomegranates are olives and quinces. He takes the English language because he came here and he makes it sing. In Latin, we might do, omanium mysterium. It works in Latin, but oh, divine mystery doesn't translate. Il est belle, bon, 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 comère. Works for he is good and handsome. So the use of language is so beautiful in how we use it. And more importantly to me at this moment, talking about Leonard Bernstein, who we met, it's the rhythm that gets you. Ya-pa-pa-pa-pa, remember? I like to be in America. You got da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's what's so catchy. And he takes rhythmic changes like that, and you don't forget it. Never forgot. Thank you. Never forgot.
So we've been awakened by the shepherds, but then everyone goes to sleep. And the temptation of the king's gifts in her home is too much for the mother. Let's listen. She takes the gold. The king's page catches her. And then Amal leaps up to defend his mother.
Would you dare ugly man hurt my mother?
Then the kings forgive her. And after that, she realizes she wants to give a gift to the child too, but she has nothing to offer.
This is where I get awfully verklempt. Every time I saw it, he looks at his mother. But Mother, I can offer my crutch. And he takes a step forward, and she says, no, no, and he keeps on, and he starts to walk.
Okay, stick a fork in me, I'm done. It's just...
Get the Kleenex, will you, Robin?
But Ron Cohen, we've been, you know, so moved by hearing just these portions of this. What do you want to say to NBC?
Gee, my dream is for this network, which really brought us Peter Pan recently and did The Sound of Music, would bring back this beautiful little jewel. And the one and only Audra McDonald, who was meant to play the mother, would do it. And it would be given to young people today and for future generations. We need to have this come back. It is such a precious and a little jewel. It's beautiful.
From your lips, Ron Cohen. Former choral director at John F. Kennedy High School on Plainview, Long Island. My former choral director. Ron, Mr. Cohen, Mr. Christmas, as we called you. Merry Christmas.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you kindly.
Thank you. Yes.
With your crutch,
you can tie it to my back.
Don't.
So, in the end, Amal says goodbye to his mother and goes with the kings to bring his crutch to the child in Bethlehem.
So, my darling, goodbye.
So, my darling, goodbye.
I don't know if I'm going to get through this. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.